Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from The Oldie. The programme is dedicated to the memory of Sir David Amis, MP, who died doing his job. As we stare down the barrel of yet another Christmas lockdown in the ongoing saga of the COVID pandemic, as politicians wrangle about wine and cheese or business meetings rather than Christmas parties, in this edition of the Oldie Podcast, we talk to the Right Honourable Sir Lindsay Hoyle MP, the 158th Speaker of the House of Commons, whose role is delivering the daily business of politics. It is he who has to restore the traditional values expected of those we elect to represent us. And it is he who has to ensure that MPs can go about their daily business unhindered, safe in the knowledge that they do so without risk from the unwanted and unwarranted attention of those remote elements of society intent on spreading malice, causing harm, and even death. I met Mr. Speaker Hoyle in his chambers in Westminster. I hope you enjoy the programme.
Mr. Speaker, you been in place for 2 years, having been Deputy Speaker before that. But presuming now you're caught between a rock and a very hard place, because on one hand, we're dealing with the allegations of second jobs and the reputation of MPs. And then on the other hand, we've got the defence of good people going about their work, diligent, hard-working members of Parliament who are trying to represent their constituencies, yet there is a constant threat to their own lives. We've seen with Sir David Amis and previously with that with Joe Cox. And that is the tragedy, the dichotomy of the situation right now. How do you balance this out, and how do you restore politics' reputation as it is today?
I think, first of all, to go back, yes, I am the 158th Speaker. I've come into that. And I think, like everything, that the one thing about 158 Speakers is we're all different. We always have a different view and interpretation of how we actually deliver. And it is about the delivery of the way, the role, and how you see it going forward. And you're absolutely right. We went through the terrible time of the expenses scandal. The fact is the public, we became the lowest of the low in public opinion. What I wanted to try and do when I became Speaker was try and refresh the view of public opinion, trying to take the tarnish away from this Parliament, to try and make Parliament... I don't say the public will always love us, but I think that what I want is the respect that people put themselves forward. They want to be MPs because they want to do the best by the people they stand for. Whatever the party are, the reality is people put themselves forward. They are decided upon or not, depending on the case and be whether they get elected. And if elected, they've done it, and I generally say this, for the right reason, and that is to serve the constituency that they've been elected to represent. And I think that's what's so, so important to me. I think, you know, without touching Brexit, but what I do say is about MEPs, when they had an area where they represented, people knew who to go to. The moment became a regional list system, they lost that personal contact that MPs have. And that's what really, really matters to me, is that public engagement with your constituents, with the MP. And you're right, we've been through a very dark cloud again. That dark cloud came with the situation of the reporting to standards, and it was a very damning report, and the member concerned, you know, people read the report, they made their views known, have to read in that report, and the fact that the report wasn't endorsed at the time made life difficult. What I would say is hopefully we've now moved on from that. It has passed today, the report's been accepted, and we begin to move forward. But as you quite rightly say, it is damaging, not to just the few people that may have stood out or to the government. It damages the reputation of all MPs. So equally, I believe that we're all treated once again with suspicion, thinking that we're all earning this extra money, that we have total regard for the people we represent, and that we'll sell our soul. The reality is that is not the case. Mm. The reality is that we have very good MPs across the House, of all political parties, that do it for the right reasons I said earlier. This is about MPs representing their constituents, serving their constituencies, and doing it because they believe, one, in democracy, but two, is trying to make a difference for people. And I genuinely say that across the board. So what I want to do is try and get the House back into that place again, trying to make sure people understand that we do it for the right reasons. Because in the end, democracy matters. And you touched on David Amess. These people who attacked Joe Cox, David Amess, the attack on Parliament, they have one thing in common. They don't share our values. They don't believe in our values. They don't believe in our democracy. But they will never win. We united, and we will continue to be united in this House against hate, against the vile views that they have of people who believe in democracy. Democracy will survive because we stand together, and that's what really, really matters. Of course, the consequence is that we are open to our constituents, and that is a good thing. The fact is, we have to represent constituents. You can only do that by being in touch with constituents, dealing with the issues of constituents. That's what makes our system pretty unique. That's why I genuinely believe that we are the envy of the world in the way that we run our democratic system. And I've got to say, we've got to support MPs to make sure that we don't have another Sir David or a Joe Cox. I've got to say, we've got to do what we can to protect MPs. We've got to make sure that democratic values are upheld in this country. We've got to support the people that are elected. It's so, so important. These people, they don't believe in democracy, they don't share our values. They shouldn't interfere with what we believe in. What I would say is, if they disagree with what we stand for, do it like I do it. Put your name on a ballot paper. Let people judge you. If you're so right, I'm sure you'll get elected. But if you're so wrong, please accept it. You've been rejected.
You typify that sense of service. Your father, Baron Hall, Lord Hall, was an MP for many years before. You were, for 19 years, a councillor in Chorley, and ended up actually as mayor of Chorley, I think, if that's correct. Having also running your own business at the same time. What is it that drives you? So you know, you've been 24 years MP for Chorley, so nearly 50 years of service to Chorley itself. You are of the people. And what is it that drives you to do the job that you do, which is not a giving, it's not a forgiving job by any stretch of the imagination, is it?
I think it's like everything. It's about, what are your values? What do you believe in? And I believe in the area I represent. There's not many of us that can say we were born and brought up in our constituents and lived in the constituency we're elected for. I can say that's what I've always done. So, of course, I'm around the people who I know. I believe in the area I represent. That matters to me more than anything. I wouldn't be Speaker of this House if it hadn't been to the people of Chorley. I would never have been a councillor if it wasn't for the village that I still live in to this day. The people of Adlington elected me to serve them on the council way back in 1980. And I've got to say, I've never had a break from public service in Chorley. Did I want a break? Absolutely not. Because it is my privilege to be able to represent, first of all, the village on the council, to become mayor of the town, deputy leader, I held nearly every position on the council, and also then to become the MP. I say to MPs, we are very lucky people. It's a privilege to have such a position bestowed upon us through the democratic process. And the fact is that, you know, I'm still here, still representing Chorley, still being part of Chorley. People say, oh, what's it right living in London? I go home to Chorley at weekends. And what I would say is, I have a very wonderful job. And it's a privilege to be the 158th Speaker. But I still live in Chorley. Because that's what matters to me, is those people. When I go around Chorley Market or Booth Supermarket, I do the stalls, I do all that. People talk to me because that's how I get informed. I know what people think. And do that because they see me, they're out there, they can stop and talk to me. And that matters to me. In the same way that I hold my surgeries to discuss the issues and the problems they have. I get involved in everything. I try to, you know, the scout movement, the air cadets, you know, whatever it be in Chorley, you know, the youth son, you know, this was a great inspiration of having a youth son in Charlotte with thousands of young people who are members. You know, all that is happening in Charlotte because we make it happen. You know, the extension to the town centre. It's not just about the council, it's about me working with the council. This is about trying to do the best by Charlotte, trying to always improve Charlotte, making Charlotte a better place to live. And, you know, wherever I can sell Charlotte, I'm always there to sell it. Whether it was the G7 Speakers Conference, who everybody said, oh, you'll be having it in London. Absolutely not, we're going to Charlotte. Charlotte is what it matters. I'm going to show Charlotte off to Nancy Pelosi, you know, the Italian speaker. I want people to come and see what's about me. What matters about me? Where I live. This is fantastic to be in this office. But I just love Charlie. You know, and I'm Charlie through and through. People said to me, oh, you're always bothered about that hospital. I said, I will be. That's the hospital I was born in. You know, so I've not just walked into this. I've actually always been in there. I've evolved within Charlie. I am Charlie through and through. I'm Lancastrian. Proud of my Lancashire roots. And that's what really, really matters to me, is to represent the North. As I say, representing Lancashire, but in the heart of that is Chorley. Chorley is the heart of Lancashire. And Lancashire, of course, is just the main body of this country.
Because you have it very lucky, don't you? I mean, it's an easy job for you in that sense, because Peter Kay does most of it for you.
Peter Kay, Dave Sparky. Dave Sparky lives in Chorley, you know, there they were. But, you know, they are around. What I would say is that Charlie's got this great history that's hidden away. There's so much about Charlie, and I love to tell the story. You know, Horton Towers go right back to 1066. You know, the family's existed there. This is the place where Shakespeare lived. Shakespeare lived in Charlie. He lived at Horton Towers. The fact is, the loin of beef was knighted in Charlie. It was known as the loin of beef, but it became the sirloin. When James I stayed there, he knighted the beef in Charlotte. You know, we talk about the Pilgrim Fathers. The fact is that the Pilgrim Fathers, the captain of the militia, Miles Standish, who escorted them out there, came from Charlotte. The crypt is in Charlotte. The stall that he prayed at is in Charlotte. You know, so we've got this wonderful history. That's before we start talking about Henry Tate of Tate and Lyle, and we talk about the art galleries. These people are from Chorley, and that's why it matters. Peter Kay's a bit coming lately. And of course, you know, Chorley FM coming in your ears, coming all over, you know. We know that was part of it. The bottom line is, he did put it on the map. But we've history after history of people who came to Chorley or were from Chorley that went out there selling it. You know, you can go to Rome, you know, and you will see martyrs, Catholic martyrs.
But it's remarkable. I need to get to Chorley. I think that is really
very much so.
Very much so. I'm looking forward to it. I'll come down one week, Mr. Speaker. But going on from there, you talk about your work and how you are holding your own constituency surges and so on and so forth. And we've spoken also about these three individuals who attacked Parliament, who attacked and killed Joe Cox and killed Sir David Amos. Do you feel that fear when you're sat there in your surgery? Do you think that you need to be protected in any way so that you're almost more inaccessible to your constituents, which is of course the vital part of the job?
I don't think about it in that way. What I've got to think about is the staff that work with me. I've also got to think about the people who are coming to me. They're the people that matter. I know it's strange, isn't it, because they're the people I affect their lives in what I do. So it's important that we do the right things to make sure those people who work with me have the support and have the protection they put in place, and quite rightly making sure that we hold the surgeries in the right place, in the right venue where it's secure. So I always try to do that. Do I change my life? No. Do I still walk around the market? Do I still call up Mr. Brown's or Pat's cheese stall or the fish stall on the market? You know, am I going to go to Mason's for my bacon, toasted pound cake, you know? Of course I am, yes. And that's what my life's about. It's about where I live, and it's about getting the best out of life. I've got a fantastic job. I represent the best constituents in the country, and therefore I want to be in the heart of my constituency. So I want to be seen, and I want to carry out the way that I feel comfortable with, and that's what it's about feeling comfortable, taking security seriously, but trying to make sure I can carry out the job that I was elected to do.
You talked about having the best job in the world. You succeeded the 157th Speaker after a particular period of great political turbulence. And some could say you had it sort of easy in that sense of coming in after all the sort of the battles and so on were fought. What do you think are the qualities that make a good speaker?
I think first of all, you say it was all over. I think that when I arrived, but you know, Speaker Bercow decided to step down. I was elected to take over. Brexit hadn't been completed. We had to see Brexit through. I think we hit the biggest thing that everybody thought Brexit would be the biggest thing that would happen to Parliament. It was superseded when the world realised that COVID, and we're still suffering with COVID. So I'm going to say it's been a challenge all the way through. What do I want to be as Speaker? I want a Speaker. I want people to have trust in me. I want people to try and respect the job that I carry out. But it's also about my impartiality. I want people to realise I am impartial. I try to do the best by everyone in this House. And that's whether it's the Green Party right through to the government of the day. I want to try and look after every MP in this building. I want to show fairness. And I want to show transparency in the way that I do my job.
In that sense, the Speaker is the authority of the House of Commons, and it seems perhaps unfortunate that Mr. Speaker Bercow wasn't enabled afterwards. But it seems to be, he had a rough ride to go. Well, do you think that's fair to say?
I think every speaker, I think in history there is turbulent times, as we know. Mm. Quite a few lost their head. Mm. So it's never an easy job.
No.
People are always looking to blame somebody, and I think that's what happens to speakers. It's very easy for them to be blamed. And quite rightly, Speaker Bercow's name did go forward. Mm. And therefore, it is for others to decide. But, I was very clear at the beginning, he's been Speaker. Speakers' names do go forward, and it was quite the right thing to do that his name should go forward, and then it is for others to decide.
Yeah. Why is it, do you think, that it always seems to be that the Labour speakers are the more renowned, the more memorable, I suppose special. I mean, I'm thinking of Lord Tony Pandy.
Depends what kind of special you mean, as well.
I think Lord Tony Pandy, Betty Boothroyd, wonderful people, including yourself, in that you come across as being very approachable, very very normal, and just very very human about the whole thing. I suppose that's just surely speaking to us all. Why is that the case, do you think?
I've got to say, Tony Pandy, I didn't really know. It was my father was around when he was Speaker of the House. What I do know is that Burroughs Boothroyd is a great friend of mine. I respect him. I think she's a wonderful person, apart from coming from the wrong side of the Pennines, but sometimes you've got to forgive these things. But the fact is that she gives me advice, and I just think it's wonderful that I can have a relationship with somebody who is an icon. An icon of being the first woman speaker, but she was very special in the way that she held that position. Mm. And the respect and love across this country, even now. Mm. It's a few years ago since she was speaker. I'm the third speaker after Baroness Boothroyd, but she's still there. She'll ring me up. Now, lovey, what are you up to? I just want to let you know you're doing the right thing, but just make sure you're wearing the right outfit. And then she'll ring up and she'll call him. Where is he? He's just in a meeting. Tell him I'm having dinner tonight. I'll be there at 7:30. Make sure he's there. And that's lovely, isn't it? Yeah. And that's the kind of relationship I have. Yeah. I have this great respect for it. And the fact is that it's wonderful to catch up with her. Because the story she tells me about what she did, but it's also the advice that she can give me. And I think that's fantastic, that I can have that lovely relationship with somebody who's got so much experience, and she shares it and advises me in a very positive way. So I'm just going to say it's a true friendship. As they always say, Lancashire and Yorkshire might fall out, but the North will always unite against the South.
All right, all right. the traditions that you touched on, the traditions of the House and the Speaker, the Speaker's position, the great robes of office and so on, and how Betty Boothroyd checks out what you're wearing, make sure you're... but in this modern day and age of people wanting to see politics change and reform, do you think it is time to completely do away with the robes of office, these great robes of office that we see all around us in this wonderful room of all the previous speakers that have gone before?
I think things matter, don't they? I think tradition matters in this country. You know, it's very easy to give up on things. If you give up, you never get it back. Mm. So I think it's about respecting the office, respecting tradition, and using it at the appropriate times. Mm. So
I mean, you're sat here in morning coat now and so on, and that is your daily wear.
I think it's about me respecting the office, and I dress according to the office that I hold. You know, I don't go the full way. The argument about I should be wearing a wig in the chair. You know, I think there's a limit to some things that we need to and need not to do. What I want to do is show the respect of the office by dressing in the way that I do. I do believe people expect me to be dressed in this way. I think if I was just to sit in the chair with an open neck shirt and a sports jacket and trousers on, nothing wrong if that's, you know, what I might wear at weekends, but it's certainly not what people expect me to wear in the chair. So I respect the office, and on the big state occasions, I go even farther in the dress that I hold, and I think that is the right thing to do. I look at it the other way. You know, I'm very lucky. One of my, you know, things I do outside of the house is I'm the Honorary Colonel of 3 Mental Regiment. And quite rightly, you know, I respect that honour. I respect that I wear at the appropriate occasion the uniform that matters and the uniform they would expect me to. So if I can do that when I'm not doing the Speaker's job, the least I should do is respect the Speaker's job in the same way as I do that job.
That position of respect is what you've got to build back for our current MPs today, isn't it, Rasmus? Because that's what it's all about, isn't it? It is about, you know, you have to guide the House accordingly.
It is, and it's about taking the House with you. It's about trying to make sure the House believes in what you're doing. And that's what I try to do, you know. I think it is important. You look back and you look at the history, and I try to think, you know, I look around this room and they've all got wigs on. Do I really need to wear the wig? The question is no. There's one or two that are not, but the rest are. And they were the great robe of state. And I think that is important on that big occasion. If the monarch is coming to this house, should I be dressed appropriately? Of course I should. And do I believe MPs think I should be dressed? I think the answer is yes. Mm. I think 99.9% would think I do the right thing. And I'm sure if I wasn't, they'd all come and tell me. And what I would say is I think... And I'd like to believe that people respect that I'm fair, I'm honest, and I try to live up to the job they've elected me to do. Because in the end, I'm the choice of Parliament.
You were the unanimous choice of Parliament. Because technically, I think, if I'm right in thinking, that the Speaker's always meant to be dragged to his chair because it's a job he never wants to have.
I've seen a few run to it, but there you are.
How do you fend off? You must get, obviously, at times... heavily lobbied by MPs themselves, wanting to ask questions or get your attention. How do you fend them off?
I say to people, I don't want to fend people off. I always try to make sure my door's open for MPs to come and see me. I've had a few meetings with backbench MPs today already, and I think that's important. I want to be approachable. I want to be able to be there for them, listen to what the issues are, and try and deliver on the problems if they have problems. Also about supporting people who may have a case that needs to be heard, that they need to get that promoted. It could be a significant constituency problem that needs to be resolved, and the only way you can do that is it could be through a backbench debate in that sense, or the end of day debate. debate, you know, in the German debate, we can try and help to make sure that they get a platform in which to raise the issues. And I think that's what's so important, that it is about supporting MPs and raising their issues. Because in the end, whether you've been here 30 years or 3 months, there are still issues that need to be raised on behalf of constituents. And it's about trying to make it fair and equal for everybody and trying to make sure everybody gets a fair crack of the whip. And I was looking at some debates today that I was just, I looked to see how many people had already had them. I was trying to pick out the ones who haven't had a debate because we need to hear their voice as well. Not the same voice, because the danger is there's quite a few, you know, that push for everything, and some others who don't push when they need it. That's the time to give it. And that's what I tried to. I tried to be fair. I tried to respect everybody, and I tried to ensure that nobody's left behind. In the same way that questions to the Prime Minister, if you don't get drawn out, there may be a chance that somebody might catch my eye. If you're not asked a question, you might catch my eye a little bit more than somebody who has.
Are there any outrageous attempts to catch your eye? Where people float themselves and anything?
But you've seen them, they'll throw themselves down on the bench. You know, and the clerks, you know, you get the Jim Shannon of this world that wants to be on every question, speaking everything, and Jim's such a lovely guy. And he gives you those big sad eyes. You know, he makes an old English sheepdog look happy, you know.
do you lament the passing of some great characters from the backbenches, especially in the Labour Party and so on, who perhaps aren't here today? Some of the great characters of, you know, I'm thinking back to people like Austin Mitchell.
Austin Haddock.
but then you've got the great Beast of Bolsover, Dennis Skinner, these great sort of MPs, parliamentarians in their own right, in their own individual way. Do you think politics today is less characterful?
Have we got the great performer of the stage? There'll never be another Dennis Skinner, will there, in that sense? And I've got to say, you know, I've got the greatest respect for Dennis and had the privilege of serving with Dennis in the House of Commons. And Dennis was something special, wasn't he? He was a showman, without doubt. He knew how to hold the House and he used to get the best out of the House. And he used to worry them as well, you know. And I've got to say, Dennis at his best, you know, he could really let rip. Which you know, in the way that only Dennis could do it. Of course, you know, you can go back, Bessie Braddock, you know, there's some great people in history that's
George
always
Brown,
been
George
able
Brown.
To hold. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so they do come along, and they will go, and somebody else will come. And I've got to say, there's always an up and down in politics, isn't it? I would say, you know, you look at 1997, you come into the House, there were still some very strong Conservatives who'd been in government, that were still around. Big Beast, you know, whether it was Ken Clark, John Major, they were still there. Mm. People seem to have forgotten that, in the sense that the Labour government of 1997, a huge beast. In fact, you had three or four Prime Ministers, not one that could have done that job, which is pretty unique. And it takes, it's a cycle, isn't it? Mm. And they all come round. And I think you go into a lull and then we'll come back out and we'll see the huge beast in all parties suddenly rise up again. And that's how it will come. Mm. You know, politics better for stronger people on those benches.
But do you think the sort of the bureaucracy that surrounds being an MP today, or the administration, the extra workload, the people talking about being social workers and so on, do you think that dumbs down the ability to be perhaps the character that one would want to be?
Depends, doesn't it? I suppose people make their minds up. What kind of MP do you want to be? Mm. Do you want to be the thorn in the side of the government? Or, you know, the thorn, even if it's your own government? Mm. You know, it is about, do you want to be a very strong backbencher? Do you want to climb the greasy pole? People do it in different ways. And it's interesting to watch, you know, the people come along, people go, people stay around. It's difficult. When people come into the House and maybe it's not what they wanted, then disappear after one term. Mm. People do stand out. Mm. You know, so it has been, it's difficult, because the one thing is that I said 158 speakers are all different. The one thing is 650 MPs, they're all different as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the ones we don't see from Sinn Féin, they're still MPs, you know. But we all do it. We're all individuals and we'll all do it slightly different. And I've got to be careful, I don't want to upset the Whips, but you know, you can be yourself. You can be that politician that believes in the constituency. You might not get into being either in the shadow cabinet or the government or whatever, but at least you're honest to yourself in that sense. Because in the end, I always say, it's never the Whips that elect you. It's your electorate. You've got to face them every election. So remember that, you know, because other people remind them if you've forgotten, don't you worry. So, you know, I always think that's why you're always got to try and put your constituents first.
Do you find that with the Conservative Party, which has a thumping majority like it does now, does that make your job harder to make sure that they adhere to the rules of the House?
I think there's two things. People say, well, with a majority like that makes your job a lot easier in some respects. You're absolutely right, Captain, because you know what the vote will be.
Yeah.
But what it does do, it allows a government, if you're not careful about it, to actually make the House secondary.
Mm.
And that's the danger, because they don't feel they're accountable because they've such a large majority.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I say, it's interesting when they don't make a statement in the House and they decide to make it elsewhere, or they brief the media.
Yeah,
they think it's the opposition that complains. Let me tell you now, a lot of the first people to complain to me are the government's own backbenchers, who say to me, this is appalling, this camera. And that's why I'm elected, to stand up for the backbenchers. Whether it's the government or it's the opposition parties. The fact is, I believe in this House. I believe that the government is answerable to this House. The ministerial code tells them they're answerable to this House. And we've got to get them back into respecting this. We haven't got a president. We have a monarch.
Hmm.
And we have a government that's a prime minister. That prime minister is also an MP. He's elected to this House. And therefore, they are answerable to this House. And that's why I'm so passionate to make sure we hear it in this House first.
Mr. Speaker, when you and Catherine get home late for night, how do you relax in the evening?
I usually then have to start sorting the cat out. You know, he'll want to go brushing or whatever. You know, he'll make a nuisance of himself. He's not seen me all day. So, you know, the reality then steps in, isn't it? You know, and I think it is about that. Do you switch off? I read all the newspapers every day, as many as I can. I read the papers, they matter to me, I have the news on. So, you know, how do you switch off? It's a very good question. Do we ever switch off? I think the only time I really switch off is if I'm watching the cricket or the rugby league. You know, those are the kind of things that really make me switch off. Obviously, if the grandchildren are there, I switch off in a different way. There's no relaxation, let me reassure you. But yes.
I think that. It's fair to say, Mr. Speaker, thank you so much for being my guest on the Audi Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And my thanks once again to Mr. Speaker Hoyle. Until next time, thank you for listening. And from me, Harry Butnell, keep smiling, stay safe, stay well, and farewell. With editing by Michael Ciliani, this has been a GameKeeper production for the Audi.
I had to bring Peter Kay. I kept thinking, while we were talking about this Chorley FM, I kept thinking, you know, we've got to bring him in at some point.
I nearly mentioned the Alan Clark story, you know, when you were saying about respect with Alan Clark, when Margaret Thatcher said to him, "You're a vegetarian." He said, "Prime Minister, I don't think it would look good if I turned up in plastic shoes."